You're listening to Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. Ever study those anthills? You look at them closely and you marvel at the perfectly organized little trails that the ants have across their territory. Or how about when you go snorkeling by a school of fish and you see every single one of those fish is swimming along at the same speed. They keep the same distance from each other. I don't know how they know how to turn together, but that's something else. Well, bees and locusts, they move in swarms also. And even humans, we humans walking through Times Square or Grand Central, we don't move in swarms. We move in something they call rivers to minimize the friction of all of us bumping into each other. But swarm behavior isn't just about movement and traffic patterns. Humans can think in a swarm, you know. You ever hear the wisdom of crowds? Well, what does that really mean? If you had 100 people guess the height of the Empire State Building, what are the chances the average of your guesses would hit the answer on the nose? That's the sort of question my next guest talks about in his book, The Perfect Swarm, The Science of Complexity in Everyday Life, some of the unexpected logic of swarm intelligence, like viral marketing on the internet, investing in open source software, even how much we trust our government. All that has to do with swarms. And joining me to talk about it is Len Fisher. He's author of The Perfect Swarm, The Science of Complexity in Everyday Life. He joins us today by phone from merry old England. Hi, welcome to Science Friday. Len, are you there? Len, hi, how are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you very much. Can you hear me clearly? You haven't just lost me, have you?
No, 5x5, as we used to say in the old radio days. Tell us about swarm intelligence. Can you define it for us?
Yeah, using the group to make a better decision than most of the individuals in the group would be able to make. But I think you have to distinguish between swarm intelligence and the sort of genuine decision making that especially people do, and swarm behavior, which is the sort of thing that fish and birds and so on do when they move together.
Mm-hmm.
When fish and birds are doing it, they're just following three very simple rules. They're only looking at their neighbors, and all they're doing is they're avoiding them. They're not trying not to crash into them. They're aligning themselves with them, so they're following them, and they're staying close to them. And when you put those three rules into a computer, as a guy called Craig Reynolds did, an animator now, he found that he could get little particles moving just like flocks of birds. Wonderful to watch.
I'll tell you, that's just how people move through Grand Central. You know,
I think it pretty much is, but you have to get the crowd sufficiently dense. I mean, I've tried this with a few friends. You get yourself a decent-sized group of people, and when you're just all wandering, when there's plenty of space, you can get past, no problem. As the crowd starts to get denser, it spontaneously organizes itself into what we call rivers. And you can make this happen just by getting a few of you and gradually crowding up the people around you. And you'll see they'll go into a river.
Oh, I'll be there at 4:45 today. I'll know exactly what that river looks like. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Talking with Len Fisher, author of The Perfect Swarm, The Science of Complexity in Everyday Life. You know, you touch on the book something that I heard a while back that was I thought was wrong, but it turns out you talk about it, and that is the ability of crowdsourcing, of asking people for their opinion about something and then asking an expert, and the crowd of random people get it right more than the expert does.
Well, that's right. You've got to pick your problem to make this sort of spontaneous intelligence work, this sort of swarm intelligence. But if you pick the sort of problem where you're trying, like as you were saying, trying to estimate the height of the Empire State, as long as you get the people in your group, all of whom have a little bit of information, if you take an average of all that, you can prove mathematically and logically that the average will be much closer than almost all of the guesses. And when you can try it for yourself, I've tried it, you just get a jar of jelly beans or something like that and get a whole group of people to guess how many are in the jar. Most
right.
of them will be miles out. The average will be terribly close. Again and again, it works really well. The reason why it works is because the people are making up their minds independently and because you've got a diversity of opinion. And those two are the absolute keys to making swarm intelligence work. It's independence and diversity. So long as you've got that and maintain it, then you get good decisions with these sorts of problems.
Yeah, and you talk about that as opposed, that individuality, as opposed to what happens in a jury where everybody is talking to one another. You get a different kind of decision-making going on there.
Well, yes, I've been arguing this, but not very successfully, because most people think you get juries of 12 good people and true get together and they thrash out the arguments and will come to a consensus, which is right. In fact, and I think there's quite a few experiments that show this in principle, if the people all made up their own minds independently before they talk to each other, they have a much better chance of coming to the right decision than by getting together and talking straight from the beginning. And it's very contrary to what most people do or what most people think.
And why,
is
that?
Argument for
Well, what goes on in the jury room that's different than if they're alone by themselves or making their own decision?
Well, there's a couple of different things that can go on. One is just straightforward bias, where you get a few people in the jury that may have stronger characters than the rest. And so they carry the others towards their point of view. And so you've lost out on the diversity because you've only got a few points of view being represented and everybody else following along. But the other thing that you can get, which has been written about, obviously, in a book called Groupthink, is where you get the group and they start to think very well of themselves. They start to think, we've really got this as a group. And when that happens, they start to ignore outside arguments and outside evidence.
Hmm.
That's the sort of thing that happened famously, I think, with the Challenger inquiry.
Right.
And where Richard Feynman was involved, the scientist. He was the only scientist in it, and they were convinced that they had it right about their understanding of management and what was wrong.
He went and talked
to the scientists, and he got a diversity of opinion.
He had an independent... He certainly was not a group thinker, that's for sure.
He was absolutely not a group thinker. But even so, he writes in his autobiography that he got sucked into it. He had trouble. And it was only when he actually got outside the group mentality, that he could start to think clearly as an individual.
Interesting.
Now, he was a very strong character in his own right. I've been caught up in this sort of thing. Yeah. I think most of us have, really. It's very easy to happen.
Yeah, he was very individual, again, caught up in that. In the book...
Oh, one of my heroes.
Yes, to many of us. In the book, you tell the story of how UPS, the United Parcel Service folks... optimized its delivery routes sort of based on the logic of ants. Tell us about that.
I think that's very, very neat. In fact, when it's called ant colony logic. When ants go out to search for food, and you can do this in the laboratory or you can just watch it in nature, they might find several alternative routes to the food, some of which are shorter than others. And within a very short space of time, almost all of the ants are using the shortest route. Now, how do they know? I mean, the ants don't come back and tell them. And I didn't realize until I saw how the experiment was done. It was very clever. The way that the ants do it is that they'll go out, a few ants will go out searching. The ones that get back first are the ones that have taken the shortest route, just by accident. But because they're back first, they're the ones that the next ants will start to follow. And so very quickly, all of the ants are following the same shortest route. And UPS drivers did this rather similarly. I thought it was very clever. Probably somebody was actually thinking on their feet, I suspect, from the start. But they worked out that to take a route through a city, always take as many right turns as possible, even if the route is a bit longer, because that's going to be quickest. And it's going to be quickest because you're not forever waiting to turn across the traffic.
Oh.
So even if it's a bit longer, if you build in the biggest number of right turns possible, that'll give you the quickest route, by and large.
And you're not deciding at every corner, should I go left or right? You're just taking that route.
No, you're not deciding.
Yeah.
Now, either somebody worked this out or a few guys just cottoned onto it by accident. But whatever happened, the point was that the rest of the drivers started to pick up on this, maybe for the same sort of reason ant colony logic works, because their mates were getting back first. They were getting back quickest. What did you do? How did you do that?
Right.
So they started to take right-hand turns as well. And you've got to give credit to the management of that company that it was swarm intelligence that found this solution, the swarm intelligence of all the drivers, but it was the management that picked up on it and used it to say, okay, we'll make this a policy.
Do you think
that they saved themselves a lot of gas?
That's interesting. Do you think now that we have the internet where all these people are talking to one another, is that swarm intelligence useful? Or is it because we're influencing what we think? Is it not really swarm intelligence?
It's partly swarm intelligence. Let's try to think of an example. something like the Lego company has actually created an internet platform for their users, the people who use Lego, the people who are interested in Lego, to come up with design ideas and to share design ideas.
Right.
And through that, and through being open about it, this is using the internet, I guess,
right.
They've come up with a lot of new products, and in fact, some of the people who put the ideas there are now starting to market them and develop them for themselves, which is, of course, helping Lego.
Yeah, well, we also had DARPA with those search for the nine red balloons, which was solved on the internet by in a matter of 5 hours or something like that. Let's go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Gary in Canyon Lake, Texas. Hi, Gary.
Hey, how are you today?
Hi there.
Good. I had a question. Is this type of experiment I used to do as a child, I would go into a mall, stand and stare at something at the ceiling until I attracted a crowd, then I would slip away, come back 15, 30 minutes later and see how many people were still staring in the same spot and how many were of the original group or if they'd kind of evolved. And I noted that they evolved, but it seemed like you could get people's interest on nothing for quite a period of time just out of curiosity.
Hey, good question. Thanks for that, Gary. Len, is that swarm intelligence?
I tried the same thing when I was a kid. It's been done as a proper scientific experiment as well. I think one of the keys in that is that once you get more than three or four people there, the more people you get, the more other people are going to think that it's something meaningful.
Right.
So it's what we call positive feedback, which is not what the psychologists use the term for, which is a pat on the head if you've done something well. Positive feedback is reinforcing change. The change in this case is standing and staring.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as you get one person standing and staring, there's a slight chance that somebody else will. When you get two, there's even more of a chance. And so it builds up, takes off exponentially.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it works brilliantly.
It's
a great example of positive feedback in crowds. And positive feedback is one of the things that's central to the whole idea of swarm intelligence as well, the way that things can take off very fast.
Talking with Len Fisher, author of The Perfect Storm, The Science of Complexity in Everyday Life, on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. Let's go to Washington, D.C. Hallie, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. I used the example about the jelly beans and the masses guessing the answer dangerously close based on the average. What kind of sample size do you need to generally get close to that actual?
Good question, yeah. How many jelly beans do you need and how many people do you need to make a decision on this?
Well, there's a guy at Columbia University who does this every year with his group of students, and he uses about 1,000 jelly beans. I've done it in an English pub, and I've used about 100. And I've done it several times, and over those several times, people have always been within three or four of the answer.
And how many people do you need to guess? How big does your swarm have to be?
Oh, I beg your pardon. That was a group of about 20. The students are about 30 or 40. It really doesn't matter. Even if you've only got half a dozen, you've still got, according to the mathematics, which I've got in the book, it's fairly simple, but I can't obviously explain it on radio. According to the math, even with half a dozen people, you've got a very good chance that the average will be better than the majority of the people's guesses. In fact, you can prove it.
Just half a dozen?
Half a dozen, yep.
So when my producers or half a dozen of them here outthink me, I should take their advice because they're probably right when I say something else.
They've probably been talking to each other, so they might be biased.
So that's the trick is not have anybody talk to each other, and
open
balloting.
It is a trick. There's two things about this. You've got to pick your problem, but the much more difficult thing is maintaining the diversity and the independence of opinion for a sufficiently long time. That's actually quite tricky to set up. And you've got so many people wanting to introduce bias, wanting to lead.
It almost sounds like the quantum mechanics where, you know, you influence the outcome by poking it a little bit, the thing you're looking at.
I don't think we're talking about quantum mechanics here. We're talking about something much, much more basic, even pre-Newtonian.
So where will you go next? What interests you next to think about?
Well, my aim in this book and in the books that I write is I'm trying to make science accessible. And my idea in doing it is to talk about how scientists think about the problems of life,
right,
and to show how scientists think, to share it, to make it an open process. And I started that by talking about little things like how to dunk a donut. But this book the last one, both about big problems, cooperation, small intelligence, and the one I'm writing now is about predicting disasters, which is really a continuation of those, and together they're going to form a trilogy which feed off each other.
And so you think we can use all this to actually to be useful and knit them all together?
Well, I'm doing my best to knit them all together. They do everything I write. You write a sentence. You must know this yourself. You write a sentence, and you can easily turn it into a paragraph. Some of the paragraphs you can turn into chapters. Some of those you can turn into whole books. There is just so much, but you get so much interknitting, as you say rightly, and overlap.
Do you think are people insulted when you tell them they can be modeled by a mathematical formula, how they behave as a swarm?
Well, I certainly hope not, because they can't entirely. That's one of the problems. If they could, then, of course, you could just use computers instead to do all of this deciding for us. But then you've got to worry about who's actually going to do the inputs to the computers.
Yeah.
You've also got to worry about the type of problem, because there are some problems, like a jelly bean problem, where taking an average is the best. There are other problems, very much like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire sort of problem, where you ask the audience, and the majority are very, very likely to be right.
There you go. And that's where we'll leave it. And it's a fascinating book, Len. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
You're welcome. Have a good weekend. Len Fisher is author of The Perfect Swarm, The Science of Complexity in Everyday Life. It'll tell you about how things work in life. It's quite fascinating. That's about all the time we have today. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help from NPR librarian Key Molesky. And if you missed any parts of our shows today, you can go over to our website at sciencefriday.com and download them on your podcast. And you can take them along on your iPhone app. And our video pick of the week, you can look on our videos on our website today and pick as many as you want. Or you can download them also on our iPhone app. Take them with you. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.